What if I told you that billionaires are actually trying to destroy the world? Like, have you ever seen some of the decisions that the rich and powerful make and think to yourself, what are they thinking? Are they trying to make everything worse? Actually, yeah. Some of them, anyway. But why? Why would somebody actively try to bring on the collapse of society? Well, there is a kind of logic to it. Let's say you have colon cancer. You got a tumor. One way or another, you're going to have surgery. It's going to be painful. It's going to be scarring. It's going to suck. But you have to do it. Would you rather do it early when the problem is small, or wait till it gets huge and the surgery becomes life-threatening? Early, obviously. That's why they push so hard for colonoscopies. Well, some people believe, for reasons that we'll get into, that societal collapse is coming, that it's inevitable, that our current path is unsustainable, and if it's going to happen anyway, you might as well do it early and as fast as possible. Believing, of course, that a better world is on the other side, a world where we can fix the mistakes that we inherited and remake it in our own image. This belief system, or philosophy, whatever you want to call it, is called accelerationism. And it's a whole thing. Yeah, it's a strange kind of political philosophy because it's being embraced by the extremes on both sides. Like, you know, they say you can go so far right that you wind up going left again and vice versa. Well, this is where the two extremes meet. So since we're about to head into yet another most important election year ever, I thought I would take a deep dive into accelerationism. Who's behind it, where it comes from, and why it's the worst kind of doomsday prophecy. The self-fulfilling kind. So before I jump into this, I just want to say this is not a political channel. I generally try to keep my political views out of my videos, though it does pop up every once in a while. I know because I hear about it. And for the most part, this isn't going to be a political video. It's really more about society and the future and where things are going, but there's definitely political elements in it. So if you're the type of person whose comments explode into all caps at the mere acknowledgement of an idea that you don't agree with, I suggest maybe you take an aspirin. I hear they help prevent strokes. Despite the ism in the name, accelerationism isn't so much a movement as a concept that can be applied to any political leanings, hence the fact that it's been embraced by both sides of the political spectrum. Yeah, if left is blue and right is red, then accelerationism is magnum. The basic gist, like I said at the beginning, is that if a system is doomed to fail, accelerating that system will help it fail faster. Exactly how you do that will vary on the system, but the goal is the same. Accelerate the system to the point that it can no longer sustain itself and watch it collapse. The term itself is fairly new, but this concept's been around for a long time. Actually, one early example that we can point to is none other than Karl Marx. In the same year the Communist Manifesto debuted, he released a set of statements that might be surprising today because they're actually very pro-capitalism and free trade. But they make a bit more sense next to his belief that capitalism, quote, pushes the antagonism of the proletariat and the bourgeoisie. In other words, by favoring free trade, he was hastening the revolution. He advocated accelerationism long before it had a name. He targeted capitalism, as many modern accelerationists do, but the same concepts have been applied to all kinds of societal systems, including racism, sexism, wokeism, just to name a few. One could make the argument that there's a kind of technological accelerationism inherent in the talk around the singularity from people like Ray Kurzweil, Elon Musk, Sam Altman, all those guys. The idea that the singularity is coming, that superintelligent AI is inevitable, and the better option is to help it come about so that we can shape what it's going to become. And then whatever problems arise from it, we need to start working now to innovate our way out of it. Yeah, so far, this might not sound too crazy. wait for it. But stepping back, the actual term accelerationism has been attributed to a 2008 blog post by critical theory professor Benjamin Noyce. In the post, he cited Marx and some of his own earlier writings, though he did later admit that he may have accidentally gotten that term from someone else. Yeah, there's a fantasy novel called Lords of Light from 1967 that uses the term. It was written by Roger Zelazny, although he uses it in a much different way. In the book, it's really more about like accelerating human development to a more higher level, godlike status, and the accelerationists in the book are the people working to make that happen. Noyce admits that he read the book and that maybe it kind of, you know, snuck into his brain subconsciously. Who knows? It happens. By the way, if the name Lords of Light sounds familiar, you might be thinking of the movie Argo. That's the one where Ben Affleck played a CIA agent, and they produced a fake movie to get into Iran and rescue some U.S. diplomats that were being held prisoner there. In the movie, the script that they were using to make the fake movie off of was called Argo, but it was an adaptation of Lords of Light. So now you know that. So it was Benjamin Noyce who gave the idea a name, but it was English philosopher Nick Land who took the name and ran with it. It was an idea he'd been playing with for decades, but he just didn't quite have a name for it. Now he did. It was Nick Land who made the Karl Marx connection that I talked about earlier. He wrote about it in an article that he wrote called A Quick and Dirty Guide to Accelerationism. He also named Friedrich Nietzsche, Gilles Deleuze, and Félix Guattari as members of the same group. Nietzsche needs no introduction, but I'll take a moment to explain the other two, whose names I'm sure I'm murdering. Deleuze was a French philosopher, and Guattari was a French psychoanalyst. And in 1972, they published a book together where they introduced the concept of deterritorialization. This is the opposite of territorialization, which refers to restraints that keep a system in check. Deterritorialization means removing those restraints. So you can see why Nick Land drew a line from deterritorialization to accelerationism. Could we cram more syllables into these words? Jeebus. In the 1990s, Land was part of a group that was founded at Warwick University called the Cybernetic Culture Research Unit, or the CCRU, which sounds like some kind of evil organization from a Terminator movie or something. That might have been on purpose. They fancied themselves as a collective of renegade academics who came together in part to, quote, undermine the cheery utopianism of the time, according to one of the group's co-founders, Sadie Plant. They published numerous articles, held in-person conferences, and reportedly did a lot of drugs. Is that not everybody's college experience in the 90s? No? The CCRU eventually burned itself out, and its members went on to do other things, but this is where the left-wing-right-wing split started to happen. Another influential member named Mark Fisher started blogging under the name K-Punk. He attracted a following and eventually co-wrote a manifesto that became the foundational document of left-wing accelerationism, or LX. It's Nick Land's writings that are considered foundational to right-wing accelerationism, or RX. Both sides envision a post-capitalist future and a technological singularity. LX is concerned with producing more equal, more just world after the revolution, and they believe that technology is the key to improving the human condition. Which isn't really that far off from the original meaning from Lords of Light, if you think about it. Nick Land, meanwhile, has gone further to the right. Since 2013, he's actually been associated with a far-right neo-reaction movement, also known as NRX. NRX was spun out of the blog of a software engineer named Curtis Yarvin, who posts under the name Mencius Moldbug. They're anti-democracy and pro-authoritarian, to the point that some of the NRXers actually criticized Donald Trump for not declaring himself king. Yes, the collapse of Western civilization, brought to you by K-Punk and Mencius Moldbug. So obviously there's some dangerous ideas that we're walking into here, but it helps to keep in mind that at least most of these people think that they're actually getting us closer to a better world. And that's based on the idea of the four turnings. I've been reading this book lately. Not for this video, I've had this for a while. I'm about halfway through it, but I feel like I can talk somewhat coherently about it. It's called The Fourth Turning Is Here, and it's written by Neil Howe, and it's a follow-up to a previous book from 1997 called The Fourth Turning by Howe and the historian William Strauss. Now, seeing me hold up this book is causing every single one of you guys to have at least one of three reactions right now.
Yes.
Jesus Christ.
Yes, finally. Yeah, just do this.
This is a polarizing book. To some people, this is gospel. To others, it's garbage on par with the writings of Nostradamus. But to those who are unfamiliar, the basic gist goes like this. The theory of the four turnings, which is also called Strauss-Howe generational theory, basically makes the argument that civilization is cyclical, that it operates in cycles. This mostly applies to Western civilization, but very specifically to the United States. These cycles last for about 80 to 90 years, roughly the length of a long human lifespan, and they've named these cycles saeculum, which is an old Roman word that has a similar meaning. And each of these cycles is made up of what they call four turnings. It's kind of like seasons of a civilization. They name those seasons the high, the awakening, the unraveling, and the crisis. And each of these lasts about 20 or 30 years. It works like this. Each saeculum is defined by a major crisis point, a world-changing event that upturns established institutions and is usually punctuated by a massive war, a total war in their parlance. This is the last turning in a saeculum, so they call this the fourth turning. Many proponents of this theory consider World War II to be the most recent crisis era. Following the crisis is the high period, the first turning of a new saeculum. This is when peace returns and society's on an upswing. It's an optimistic era. Social cohesion is high, community involvement is strong, and a collective vision for the future is widely shared. In the U.S., the post-war years of the 50s and the early 60s were our most recent high period, which is why it's often romanticized as the good old days. When people say they want to make things great again, this is the time period they're often talking about. The second turning is called the awakening. This is when the strict social conformity of the high period starts to wane and people start to search for more individual autonomy, often through spirituality and cultural rebellion. Whereas the crisis years are marked by political upheaval, the awakening years are marked by cultural upheaval. This is analogous to the consciousness revolution of the hippies in the 60s and 70s. The third turning is the unraveling period. This is basically the opposite of the high period, where collective energy is at its lowest point and individualism is at its height. It's marked by a lack of trust in government and institutions, and as a result, inequality begins to grow and divisions form in society. Divisions that eventually lead back to a crisis period, bringing a close to the saeculum
and the cycle starts all over again. Now, the reason this works, and the reason it's called generational theory, is because each generation is kind of shaped by the turning that they're brought up in. And as they get older, they seek to change the world away from the values that were imposed on them when they were young. You know, everybody wants to undo the problems that they inherited. So there's an idea, or a saying, I don't think it's really tied to this book or anything, but it's that, you know, a generation that goes through war and experiences all the terrible things that war, you know, brings about, you know, they come out of it wanting to never see war again. And then their children grow up having heard all the stories about how terrible things were, what their parents went through, and they actually see some of the scars, physical and emotional, that they carry with them. So they avoid war as they get older. But it's the grandkids that come along, and of course they want to rebel against their parents, and they begin to romanticize the purpose and the greatness of their grandparents' generation. And then war and conflict become attractive again. Anyway, according to this theory, the different generations fit into different archetypes based on the turning that they were brought up in. And these archetypes are prophets, nomads, heroes, and artists. And as time progresses through the different turnings, each generational archetype has a different role to play in those turnings. And I think at this point I'm going to step back from it a little bit, because this does get really granular and really detailed and, frankly, exhausting. And there's actually like three different books that they've published that break all this down. But I think you get the point. But just to bring this point home, they consider World War II to be the most recent crisis point. 80 years before that was the Civil War. About 85 years before that was the Revolutionary War. 75 or 80 years before that was a Glorious Revolution in England. And it keeps going. But the proponents of this theory have tracked it all the way back to the 1400s. And for those keeping count, World War II was the last crisis. So 80 years after that would be, now. Clearly, this is where the theory breaks down, because in no way are we experiencing any kind of societal crisis right now. So look, I get why this is interesting and compelling. I do have my criticisms of it. I'll get to that later. But it's this kind of thinking that fuels accelerationist ideas. You know, if there is this great wheel of time on which a crisis is inevitable and it's followed by a great high period, I mean, I can see why it's tempting to just rip the Band-Aid off and get it over with. Everybody wants to get high. It's especially appealing if you're in a position of privilege and power, be it financial, political, or otherwise, and you know that not only do you have the means to survive the crisis, but you can shape what comes after it. It's kind of like a belief in a secular rapture. But these kinds of ideas, where the ends justify the means, the end being a promise of a better world, have been used to justify horrific acts from the beginning of time. On May 14th, 2022, a man walked into the Tops Friendly Market in the predominantly black neighborhood of Buffalo, New York, and opened fire, killing 10 people and injuring 3. The killer, whose name I won't broadcast because that guy, not only live-streamed the massacre on Twitch, but had written a manifesto explaining his actions. And by the way, I feel the need to point out that he later pled not guilty in court after, you know, live-streaming himself doing it and writing a manifesto about it. Serious question. Has anything good ever come from a manifesto? Can't think of anything. Anyway, one line from this particular manifesto read, quote, "Stability and comfort are the enemies of revolutionary change. Therefore, we must destabilize and discomfort society whenever possible." The heading for that section that quote was in? Destabilization and Accelerationism, Tactics for Victory. This quote, by the way, was basically taken from another manifesto written by the guy who killed 51 people at two mosques in Christchurch, New Zealand in 2019. Hell, many people point to Charles Manson as an early accelerationist. Manson and his followers thought that a race war was inevitable, and figured that the best way to come out on top was to help it get started. To do this, they murdered at least 9 people, including the actress Sharon Tate. They thought that the grisly scenes would incite fear in white people, who would blame black men for the crimes and declare war against the entire race. But now, before you start thinking they were crazy, they actually thought that whites would lose the war and be eliminated. All of them except for the Manson family, of course, because they were prepared for it. But then Charles Manson would be able to rule over all the black people, because obviously they wouldn't be able to rule over themselves. Okay, yeah, they were crazy and racist. They were crazy racist. Not to be outdone in the crazy racist department, accelerationist language has been adopted by a lot of neo-Nazi groups in recent years, and a number of them have been arrested for stockpiling weapons and explosives, as well as committing and planning violent crimes. I'll put a couple of links to places like the West Point Combating Terrorism Center and the Foreign Policy Research Institute that talk about the specific groups and the threats they pose. You can go read it. It's sobering. Yeah, when it comes down to it, accelerationism and the four turnings theory are just another justification that terrible people are using to do terrible things. You know, and like everything else, it's on a spectrum. You know, from people who probably have good intentions, wanting to reduce the amount of suffering that a crisis would create to, you know, madmen who just want to watch the world burn. I mean, the whole four turnings thing, it's not necessarily bad on the surface, you know. Some of it kind of even makes sense. Like I said before, though, I do have my criticisms. Like, I feel like a lot of the theory behind this is that they basically saw a pattern over the last century or so, and then just kind of looked for evidence that fit their theory going back in time. But they kind of leave out things that don't fit their model. Like, World War I is just kind of skipped over as a minor war, which I don't agree with that at all. I think it might have been more consequential than World War II. I mean, far more people died in World War II, but World War I ushered in a whole new era of nation states, especially in Europe. It ended the monarchical system that had been in place for hundreds of years. Six monarchies fell around the time of World War I, including the Russian monarchy, which brought in the Soviet Union and communism, an entirely new economic model that we would be competing with for the next 80 years. Maybe you could call that the Russian saeculum. By the way, there's a great video from historian Sean Munger that I'll link below that he talks about how the six monarchies fell around World War I. It's a very long video, but it's worth a watch. In fact, I think there's a compelling argument that World War II was just a reverberation from World War I, because a lot of it was based on, you know, grievances from that first war. It's a massive reverberation, but still, it kind of finished the job. Plus, I feel like generational theory is kind of overblown. In the first place. I mean, yeah, people are born in various time periods are going to have shared experiences that shape them in similar ways. Absolutely, you know. But to say that, you know, you're a millennial, so you're like this, or you're a Gen Xer, so you're like this, I mean, eventually it just turns into zodiac signs. And this theory, by the way, it has been heavily criticized by some historians as being closer to astrology or prognostication, and for, you know, like I said, leaving out things that didn't fit the theory. Hey, Future Joe here. So there's something that got left out of the video originally, and the more I think about it, I should probably include it. There is a kind of subset of accelerationism that's becoming really popular right now. It's called effective accelerationism. And it's different from what I've been talking about throughout the rest of this video, because it's not so much focused on the collapse of society. This is really more about wanting to just unleash technology and let it progress as fast as possible, because that's the best possible way to get out of the problems that we have right now. Even the problems that come with, you know, unleashing technology. Now, I can't help but notice that most of the people who ascribe to this are sort of tech bros and venture capitalists that do have the most to gain by unleashing technology. They tend to identify themselves on social media with the tag E/ACC. People like Y Combinator CEO Gary Tan, VC fund billionaire Mark Andreessen, and the infamous pharma bro Martin Shkreli. These guys aren't necessarily politically motivated as much as they are harboring almost like a religious devotion to the idea of technology as the savior of mankind. Although they do tend to lean a little bit more authoritarian, just because democratic institutions tend to move more slowly on these things. In fact, in October, Mark Andreessen posted a blog post that sort of laid out the tenets of effective accelerationism, and he called it the Techno-Optimist Manifesto. It includes an enemies list. So that's cool. I'll put a link to it down below, as well as a link to a sort of rebuttal post so you can read it and make up your own mind on it. But I felt like it was worth mentioning because, like I said, it's not really so much about the collapse of mankind, although the people who argue against it would say that their policies would have the same result. Anyway, that's all linked down below. But you can't deny that it does feel like we're at a bit of a crisis point right now in history. And reading this does feel a little bit validating in kind of a scary way. But if you want to call it my hot take, I would say that it's not so solid that we should, you know, destroy civilization over it. And I'll be honest with you guys, I have a lot of anxiety about the future right now. I do think things are going to get worse before they get better. It's just, we're so extremely divided right now, and I don't know how we get out of it without something historically awful happening. Like, seriously, how bad would something have to be to get everyone in the United States to put down their grievances and come together to fix it? I can't think of anything, and that's kind of terrifying. And whatever that thing might be, I'm pretty sure the answer is not to accelerate it. All I can say is that history is going to do what history is going to do, and all we can do is just take care of each other. I don't know, call me naive if you want, but I think that's how we get to a better world. And if you want to create a better you, maybe invest in making your brain sharper with today's sponsor, Brilliant. To the Brilliant guys, I'm sorry. Actually, you know, if we're talking about predicting the future here, believe it or not, they have a new course on that. Kinda. Brilliant has a whole learning path around data analysis, and one of the new courses is called Predicting with Probability. Like, that's something I think that we're especially bad at as people, is understanding probability, especially around risk. So, you know, here's a way to not suck at that so much. Like, I wonder if this can actually help with future anxiety, you know? Like, make you feel more confident that you can predict what's coming. It's worth a shot. Like, right here, it says, right here at the beginning, the future is uncertain, but data can help us anticipate what's to come. Okay, I'm gonna take this. I'm gonna take this right now. Actually, wait, sorry, I gotta finish the ad read. So look, if you haven't tried Brilliant, then you haven't learned anything in your life. Even from me, you've learned nothing. Brilliant uses fun, interactive visuals and puzzles to help you learn by problem solving. What's so great about that is that it sticks. Like, you know, you can be told how to do something a million times, but you'll never learn it until you actually do it. Well, Brilliant makes you do it, but in a fun way that's more like playing games. Because your brain is hardwired to find patterns and solve problems. You are a problem-solving machine. You can't help but solve problems. If there is a problem, you will solve it. Then you will check out the hook while the DJ revolves it. Word to your mother. But because you figure out these things in your own problem-solving way, yeah, it sticks. And then you can apply that knowledge to other problems in your life. It really does kind of make your life better. And if you're worried that it's going to be a little too high level for you, don't worry. You can start at the fundamentals of math and physics, and they'll walk you through it all the way until you're doing literal quantum computing. They're adding new courses all the time, so you'll never run out of things to learn. In fact, they just added one on LLM, so the next time someone starts talking all smug about AI, you can outsmug them. It's worth the price of admission right there. And if you want to give it a try, just go to brilliant.org/answerswithjoe. You can try it out for 30 days for free, and if you're one of the first 200 people to sign up for the premium subscription, you'll get 20% off the annual plan. It's less anxiety about the future, it's extra smugness at parties, and it's 20% off. I mean, what are you waiting for? Again, it's brilliant.org/answerswithjoe. I've got the link down in the description. Go get it. Thanks a lot for watching. If this is your first time here, I got a video right here about the singularity. It's kind of old, but, you know, still same kind of stuff that I'm talking about here. Check that out, or check out any of the thumbnails that you might see on the side. If you're watching on your browser, give them a click, and if you enjoy them, I invite you to subscribe. If you're not already subscribed, I post videos every Monday. Hope you guys are having a good end to your 2023, and I hope 2024 is not as scary as this video made it sound, but you guys all go out there, have an eye-opening week. Have an eye-opening rest of the month while you're at it. Stay safe, and I'll see you next Monday. Love you guys. Take care.